You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the pleasure, once again, always a pleasure when I get to speak with my good friend, Mario Johansson. Mario and I worked together for many years. We are good friends. Mario is just one of those incredibly accomplished human beings who he's got, isn't it two masters? You've got one in philosophy and then one in what?
Well, actually, it's three now. One in philosophy, Spanish language, and then the third one now is Spanish. Urban education.
Anyway, he works at a school that is blazoned across his chest, New Road School, started in 1995. Co-started by me. It was a school I was the head of for many years, and that's how Mario and I met. He was a tutor turned teacher turned master teacher turned teenager whisperer turned just a person who sees the world and has a lot to say about it that I think is super valuable. So welcome, Mario. Thanks for doing this again.
Thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure being here.
So education, yeah? You're not tired of it yet, huh?
No, I'm actually not tired of it yet. It can be tiring at certain junctures. And right now, I think kind of nationally, we're at one of those very tiring junctures for educators. But
so tell me. How would you describe that struggle? What's the struggle, at least that piece of it, right? And we should say that New Roads is a private school, an independent school, so it doesn't suffer some of the challenges that large public schools suffer, especially in large cities. New Roads is in the Los Angeles area, but unlike most independent schools, New Roads devotes an enormous amount of its budget to need-based financial aid. But it does have certain freedoms and from some of the outside societal challenges, whether that's crowded classrooms or answering to a governmental authority that is overreaching sometimes. But having said that, it's not without its challenges. So you specifically were talking about its challenges right now. So like what do you got in mind?
Well, let me just say, I think it's important also to specify. There's one thing that I'd like to add to that, and that is that one of the major components of the establishment of New Roads for you and for Paul Cummings was create an environment that looked like Los Angeles, a school environment that looked like the city of Los Angeles, which right. Most Westside private schools don't. They are clearly catering to a specific demographic. And so New Roads comes along and says, we just want a school that one of the major features is that it looks like the city of Los Angeles. And we've been able to maintain that. It's an incredibly diverse environment that really does look like the city of Los Angeles. That in this conversation, it's true that in many respects, independent schools have been shielded from the major onslaught of what's happening in American education, some of the worst parts of it. But New Roads, interestingly, because of it being a private school with a public heart, we have an interesting relationship in terms of more folks willing to engage us in that conversation of what's happening in the public space. So we're in a very unique place where there are elements of quite frankly, elitism, right? Where we're shielded from that. But then there are other areas where we're not shielded from that, where we have lots of families where many of the majority of the kids in the family are in public schools, where they're blended families. Some of the kids are in charter, some of the kids are in public, some of the kids are in private. So, and because of the kind of school that we are, people families will engage us about the landscape of public education and how it impacts what's happening in independent education vis-a-vis a progressive school like New Roads.
And just to be clear, like I think the reason for that, tell me if I'm wrong, the reason for that that mix, that, you know, parents who have some kids, when I know a kid at New Roads and a kid someplace else and a kid at a public school and a kid looking to be in a charter school. The reason is quite specifically is, you know, families are looking for the best situation for their kids, right? And they'll put together a hodgepodge, even if it means extra driving or extra transportation, or they'll put together a hodgepodge of educational opportunities for their kids because they're looking for the best for their kids, the most appropriate for their kids.
So let's go.
Let's dive right into the hard question. One of the conversations that is, at least that I know of, that is in the public eye at the moment is, you know, affirmative action, right? Isn't it time? I mean, it's at the Supremes, the Supreme Court's talking about it, right? They're going to make a decision about it when it comes to different colleges. Does New Roads have an affirmative action approach, policy, and does that affect the students, and does that affect the teaching, and is it a good idea?
Let me see. When I think about affirmative action as a public policy, of course, I tend to think about the public implications of it, the historical and public implications of it, and how it kind of all played out. And there's a lot of feelings about that. I mean, certainly someone who is grounded in reasoning philosophically, I will be direct and say, I have a lot of issues with it. I have a lot of issues with that kind of an approach to the sociocultural and historical problem that we faced, and to use that as a measure for public redress. An affirmative action policy that specifies a demographic of people and says we want to make a special access route available for that group of people is replete with all kinds of difficulties that we could really, you know, dive into, and that could kind of that's its own conversation. The other part of that conversation is a more practical part of that conversation. The practical part of that conversation is, you know, affirmative action is largely responsible for creating America's current Black middle class, right? My family comes out of that. My mom was a recipient in the 70s of affirmative action policies. And she was one of those, you know, single moms that, you know, went to Los Angeles City College and transferred to UCLA and did her bachelor's and then all the way up to her PhD and you know, as a single mom. And so, and it transformed our lives, absolutely. And I know lots of people like that. And so, so kind of there are two mindsets when I think about, you know, affirmative action as it historically played out. Fast forward to the implications of affirmative action oriented policies that informed how schools like New Roads, inclusive progressive schools like New Roads, conduct business. I wouldn't say that there's an affirmative action policy, but would I say that many of our inclusive measures are informed by the tradition of affirmative action? Absolutely, I would say that.
So what does that look like? Does that mean you count test scores this much, but for this group of students, you count test scores only this much?
No. Fortunately, again, for us, we did not get into a calculus. So we didn't get into a calculus. We didn't get into litmus tests. We didn't get into standards like that. For us, fortunately, the founders, again, of our school, right, kind of factored into
it. I quite specifically avoided that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Play with all of those notions. And fortunately for us, thought about the problems of incorporating that into the operation of the school. But what they did was they said, okay, the intentions of what that seeks to do, right, to create an inclusive dynamic environment where people understand that you actually are more intellectually, socioculturally engaged by difference in the learning process. That when you engage difference in the learning process, you have high academic expectations, but are informed by different sociocultural and historical experiences, it actually enriches the educational journey. And so kind of what happens for us is those elements play into how admissions takes place. But we also, again, as a progressive school, move beyond race, class, gender, right? Again, the traditional conversation around affirmative action plays out at those three pillars, right? Race, class, gender. Whereas New Roads has taken this notion of diversity, differentiation, difference, and said, well, there's linguistic difference, there's sexual orientational difference, there's gender identity difference, there is neural processing differentiation, there are so many, there's linguistic differentiation. There's so many different expressions of differentiation, and the goal for us is to develop a culture and a community that is based in a radical embracing of diversity and radical embracing of difference and inclusion, and saying that that is really the center of dynamic engagement and learning.
And, well, obviously it's been successful, or it continues to be successful, and not without struggle and not without challenge and all those things. Are there challenges? Do you know of challenges to the administration of that practice rather than, hey, you know, my kid can walk on water in all these different ways. So why are you saying no?
Yeah, I absolutely have. In fact, I'm the guy that receives all of those challenges.
Oh, good.
And so I've kind of had all the gamut. You know, it brings to mind a conversation I had with a parent right not too long before we went on break, where a parent called and one of the affinity groups, an affinity group at the school, referred to, this is a Latino affinity group called Latinos Unidos, and they reached out for a dinner that they were organizing, and one of the parents called to say, hey, my child got this invitation to this Latino dinner and we were disturbed by it. Why is New Roads dividing kids up into Latin, into Black, into the... And I started explaining to the parent that the school wasn't dividing. The parent was very agitated though. The parent was very agitated and was you know, our family is very multicultural, very multiracial. We have lots of different people in our family and we don't believe in any kind of division. And what they were ultimately advocating was kind of what we refer to as a colorblind philosophy, right? We don't see color. And right. And I was explaining to the parent that first I said, well, dad, none of this is driven by the school. So let's start there. The school creates opportunities for the students to organize in the way that feels comfortable for them. So the school doesn't take any active position in requiring anything or making the students do anything. The students organize the space and the students open up the opportunity. So this particular group, Latinos Unidos, is a Latin-based affinity group, and they are inviting other Latino students in to identify with the experience and to find that commonality there in the New Roads environment. We then later got into deeper conversations about that because, again, the parent expressed some reservations about that. And I said, well, you know, if we get into the details of the program, the affinity work that we do, one of the requirements that we have two things that I'm really proud of about the way that we do affinity work at New Roads. Number one, you cannot have exclusive spaces at New Roads School. Okay. This is a long-standing contribution from our founding head of school, David Bryan, who did not believe in that, thought that was strange. And I agree with that, why would you do that in an absolute exclusive space? So at the same time, okay, how do you do affinity work and not have an exclusive space? So folks will always say, it seems like you're contradicting yourself, Mario. No, I'm not contradicting myself here. So we created a policy, you know, that is essentially referred to as welcome, not invited, right? So you're welcome into the space, but you weren't invited into the space, which means that first is that the affinity group has a responsibility every semester to facilitate activities, events where they invite community members into their space to say, this is what we're doing. Because any work that we do at New Road School is mission specific. You can't have a separate mission from what we're doing at the school. Okay. So you can't take a Latino group and say, we're organizing, it's only Latino people organizing. We have this separate agenda of the reason why we're organizing. I can support that potentially at 4 o'clock outside of school, across the street from New Road School. But when you're in New Road School, all efforts that we engage in at New Road School are mission centered. They're about the fulfillment of our mission. And so the way that that looks is you have to have events that are specifically designed to call folks in, because New Roads is a calling in culture. In this particular situation, what happened was it was just the Latino students, because they were reaching out on the basis of affinity. And now between you and me, it was a teenager thing, because they just screwed up on the instructions that they were given for how to organize the kids, right? You know, this is the kind of stuff that happens in K-12 spaces all the time. So what was supposed to happen was they were supposed to visit the campus's town halls, make an announcement, and invite the kids who wanted to speak to them afterwards for an invitation to the space.
Right.
The kids missed the town halls that they were supposed to go to. So they thought, oh, we'll just pull the names and reach out to them, which right. opportunity, a chance to have a conversation around making assumptions about people and based on names, complexions.
Right. How did you know?
You know, I ultimately said to them, Our goal is to, again, call families into this conversation. So if you could fundamentally tell me what is the problem that you have with something like this, then I would like to speak to that, because I don't necessarily think it's productive for me to try to defend the school on the basis of policies. I want to really connect with you, and I want to speak to what your concerns are. And so they ultimately said to me, well, you know, our child already has a lot of identity issues with them being a multiracial child. And so I said, well, we got into that conversation, and that ultimately is really what the conversation
we
was
have
about.
An affinity group for that as well.
And that's what I said. That's ultimately what I said is I said, first is thank you for trusting me. Yeah. And my offer and leaning into that, and then leaning into really sharing with me what's really going on within the family structure and with your child. And I want you to know that New Roads has been a place where multiracial families, transracially adopted families have found a great sense of community and belonging because of the way that we hold space. And the affinity groups for the kids are transformative spaces for that kind of work. And I think in your situation, what has happened is that your child is in the wrong space. So I have a multiracial affinity group also that grew out of the kids themselves determining, hey, right. If I go to the Black Students Union, there are conversations there that don't resonate with me. If I go to the Asian Students Union, there's conversations that don't resonate with me there. Partially they do, but they don't fully. And then that's how we ended up with the Multiracial Students Union, where those students ended up organizing, coming together and saying there needs to be a multiracial space that speaks through, within, and through, and above all of the other conversations.
And let me ask you, what's the expressed goal, or what's the understood goal of the affinity groups, or having affinity groups? Is it the comfort of the students? Is it what is it?
What is everybody trying to achieve? That's a really great question, David. So with the way that we look at the affinity work is the affinity work is an expression really of the mission also, right? The mission talks about equipping young people with the tools and the resources they need for an ever-expanding and changing world, right? Is some of the language that's used within the mission. So when we get down into the particulars of that, it's like, well, what does that look like? Well, the world we live in today is informed by this racial history that sets up a certain sociocultural dynamic. And what our objective is to speak to that and speak to the lived reality that students experience as young people coming into all of that, right? Young people often ask, well, why have we been fighting over these issues for so long? Why is it taking so long to change these issues? Why when I look back into the history, I see my mom was dealing with these issues and my grandmother was dealing with these issues. And there were issues about, you know, exclusion of LGBT folks and disabled folks and what happened? Where does all this come from? So there's the narrative part of explaining that to kids. Let me walk you through the history and give you a narrative of that. And then there's the experiential part of it. And so the affinity work is really meant to give concrete flesh and bones context to those realities and to say they can do both and, right? Kind of what Dan Siegel talks about when he says we want to honor the differences and promote the linkages. And so the affinity work gives us an opportunity to manifest that on a lived level, but also teaching the kids in the New Roads community, that's an intentional exercise that doesn't happen by itself. Our job was to create a certain structure, facilitation, and a knowledge and awareness of certain deeper things that we know, but really to front load their experience and create space for them to have the experience they need to have for transformation. When you introduce measures that are bringing people together across that wide spectrum of difference, that has to happen holistically. You don't want to put signs up where people walk in and it literally says Black, Latino, White, Asian. Okay, that doesn't work. You have to do that holistically in a way that calls folks in and feels natural for them. And so now we have this concept, holistic integration, where when we design things, we design for that, that you're going to blend people together, you're going to mix them up. So it is still the intentional part of the work, but you have to do that holistically. You cannot do that in a way that makes people feel just weird. Okay.
Well, so how does that work? Like, you know, I don't want to spend too long on this, but how do you get people to go to the right room?
So one of the things this is what happens with the affinity work is that the affinity work, they do a lot of work within their own groups themselves. And then there are spaces where the affinity group leaders are required to all come together and plan larger events to call in the entire larger student community. So you're kind of leveraging these student leaders, right? This is another thing that founding head of school taught me is you need to know when you talk about climate and culture, when adults use that language is different than climate and culture when kids use that language, but okay. It's a different wave of experience. So what I've learned to do is to have active engagement with the student climate and culture and to make sure that I have an organized relationship with those leaders. In those spaces, there's active engagement between the adult and student climate and culture, and we are intentionally coming together and again, leveraging their leadership to call more students in so that the environment, the vibe, the feel of the school says, kind of establishes boundaries for you, if you will. In other words, you don't need someone to come up to you and tell you we don't speak to women in our community like this, or we don't use certain language. I eschew those types of exchanges. I don't want to have to go up to a young person and tell them, you know, you don't talk to women X, Y, and Z, because I actually feel like that's when you're going to miss me with that kind of traditional language. What I'd like to do is I'd like to have things happen within the context of the New Roads experience that I can appeal to, direct your attention around and say, hey, do you know how that came about? Let me tell you about the young women who organized that, why they put that together and what they're trying to do with that and what role you can have with that. Now I'm getting you to think about how, you know, issues around how you engage females within our community and how they want to be regarded or treated. But I'm not turning it into this conversation around you need to be told how to talk to women in our community.
Got it. So one of the things that's got to be floating around people's minds right now is, unfortunately it all gets conflated, but there is the conversation about woke and, certain groups of people have done a masterful job, as they have done frequently in the past, of taking what was once, what was once a term to refer to healthy, progressive, right-minded practices and attitudes and approaches and turned it into something evil. And the idea of critical race theory, right? I mean, those two things. So can you talk some about how both of those, I'm less focused on the language, but both of those arenas are affecting education, if they are at the middle school, elementary, middle, high school level. I mean, how is that? You're right. I mean, woke used to be when it first entered the culture, it referred to having your eyes open to certain realities in our society. And it has become, you know, in this really brilliant and masterful way where nobody was in charge of it, but suddenly, I watched the program yesterday with Shelley, my wife, and we both at the end, it was terrible. And we both at the end of it was like, oh my God, that was just so woke, meaning the negative. And so he was like, so it worked, right? It worked. It was cliched and stupid and making an issue out of something that wasn't an issue. And it was like, what is this? Right? So is that, has that affected the conversations that students are having, or you're having, or teachers are having? And then what do you make of the whole critical race theory conversation? We know that it no longer means what it meant. So I know that's a lot. I just threw a 100 jigsaw puzzle on the table in front of you. So you know, it's only 1,000 pieces. So put it together.
I can follow you, though. I can follow you. Well, let me start with the woke thing. Is that you're right? Is that it got hijacked, and it means something very different, I think, than the folks who introduced it meant. Just like I think that the term politically correct got hijacked.
Totally. There's another brilliant one, a moment of like, suddenly politically correct is bad. Wait, what?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and there are countless other instances in the culture where you try to introduce something, or progressivism tries to introduce something. And progressivism, I've just determined that progressivism, the progressive strain in this country, cannot match the ability to denigrate and belittle like the forces of conservatism can, the forces that want to hold on to certain structures. They just can't. They just cannot keep up with it.
No.
And what happens is that the social forces that fight in front of us will reduce this conversation almost to a caricature, to ridiculousness, but they're fighting for very big stakes in the background. Okay. I mean, the idea of actually interrupting American culture and the way the business is done in the country is very threatening to very, very powerful forces.
And
so giving the kids a grounded, landed picture of actually what it means when you get people directly in direct engagement, direct activism, direct involvement, and making them understand, listen, the United States, actually, we have a cultural mythology, and then we have actual occurrences in the country. We don't really have a big, protest culture a lot of times in this country can be very isolated, but it doesn't really become responsive of big systematic matters like they do in Europe. Right. When you talk about protest movements in Europe, they tend to be much deeper, broader in scale, and they have a much deeper philosophical and historical rooting of what they're trying to address when you see social movements take place. And, you know, kind of getting the kids to see we're still engaged in a sociocultural and historical battle that is still playing out right now. And it took place. The first expression of it was Civil War, then Reconstruction, then the Civil Rights Movement, then moving forward to the George Floyd movement, and kind of giving them a landed picture and having them now start to really kind of put their teeth into, oh, okay, we're able to see what these social forces are battling over and what they actually look like in our lives. And I think that's unfortunately the piece that we missed, is how do we land this for the young people so it doesn't get appropriated, caricatured, and reduced down to you know, what's happened with woke. Because right. I said to a student very simply, I said, well, you know, woke is just a new expression of Plato's cave. I said, you know, Plato told us that we were witnessing a world of shadows. How do you move beyond looking at the world, existing in the world of shadows, and step out into the light and actually see it for what it is and build and engage the direct reality? What would that actually be like? And I said, well, woke is doing the exact same thing. I said, I'm not defending or negating either way. I'm just saying to you, the paradigm that it's set up is trying to engage the same basic concept, which is how do you move beyond myth, illusion, and narrative in order to engage authenticity? And in American culture, that's even more difficult because there are so many forces that benefit from the myth, the illusion, the narrative.
Well, is the conversation of critical race theory alive at New Road School, or nobody pays attention to it because it's so embedded in?
Well, I think that there is a general feel that we already are the dark side. Okay, I think we are. Yeah. However, yes, I will say we have still had questions about, you know, well, critical race theory, and is that what New Roads is doing? And we explain, you know, again, I explain, well, first is, you know, trying to cover some basics for folks. Hey, it's a law, it's a legal theory. Let's ground it where it is. You know, the work that Derek Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw were doing around intersectionality and critical race theory and the role that it played in law and establishing that first. And then I say to them, okay, no, New Roads is not practicing critical race theory. Are there some overlaps between what they're doing there? Yeah, just like in any history. I mean, I imagine you could take even some of the worst things that are done, even in conservative movements, and there may be overlaps with some things that we're doing, because that's the way academics work. That's the way academia works.
I think when I hear it, is there a rational kernel? Is there a nugget of something valid and real and in what people are complaining about under this now misnomer, but you know, that has been successfully renamed as critical race theory? What they're complaining about is, geez, or what they're saying at the bottom of that is, well, nobody should be made to feel bad because of their race. And, you know, everybody thinks that's true. Of course, it's very rare that it's been true for a lot of people for many years. They've felt bad because of their race. They have been made to feel bad because of their race sorts of ways.
Absolutely. Well, right. this is the issue, is that there's a very inauthentic presentation of that issue. Because sure. What will happen is that, you know, and you have, again, that's why I referred to earlier, the forces, even some of the forces that are presented to us that look progressive, that really are forces that want to keep things situated the way they were, side A, side B.
Right.
And so you often get the framing of that is, well, people don't want to feel bad because of their race. They don't complete that in saying, but the establishment of the country was specifically originated around disenfranchising people because of their race. And there have not been remediative measures that have extracted the structures that sustain that. So it's not, you know, it's not very difficult to complete.
Well, yeah, that. I mean, I think the practices, it is obviously a different world, right? Are we a post-racial society? Absolutely not. It's a very different world than it was back, you know, 300 years ago, in actual lived practices. And a lot of people, or at least a cluster of people, want those advantages, want to retain the advantages that they have had, and keep others disadvantaged because it's economically advantageous, it is socially advantageous, it is in all sorts of ways different advantageous to certain groups, And the pointing out of those disparities and the historical roots of that is dangerous, right? It is dangerous. And so the idea that, which I, you know, would be really interesting to know if that's really the case, that white kids feel bad when they hear that there were slaves, they feel bad about being white. I don't know if that's actually, I don't know if there's a way to make, right. if to find out anyways, the climate has been so contaminated. It's hard to imagine how to really tease that out. But and so jumping on that possibility, which everybody thinks of, anybody thinks is like, well, shit. Nobody should feel bad because of what color they are. And, you know, so sure, we don't want people to feel bad, but it's, but I'm not even sure that it's, that is anywhere, was anywhere in the picture. But boy, was that a convenient device to dissuade people from, educators in particular, from diving into the historical realities. And I don't mean the historical reality specifically of slavery, but what slavery allowed people to do for their own benefit. Right? So I'm going to use this thing, which is terrible. Sure, people shouldn't feel bad because of their colors. Why should anybody feel bad? That's, we know that's reprehensible. In fact, that's woke, right? We know that that's a bad thing. And you're, everybody's eyes are open to that. But we're going to use that to make sure that those conversations don't happen. It just seems so on its face obvious that this is a sort of a desperate and clever way of holding on. And holding on to the advantages of certain sorts and the unreal advantages. I mean, you know, so often people vote against their interests, right? I mean, they protest against their own interests as if somehow they're the ones who are, you know, oh, am I supposed to feel bad? No, you're supposed to feel bad because you're in a lousy job where you're not paid enough and you're not given enough benefits because those people want you to be upset about that. I don't know if that was coherent.
Oh, absolutely. But. Absolutely. Well, I mean that's why for ruling classes in the United States, you have the most ideal paradigm, right? You have, right, Democrats and Republicans who are elites. And it really doesn't matter if they battle back and forth amongst themselves, because as long as the landscape stays the same of back and forth, then markets are not interrupted.
Right.
You know, right. I mean, or at least I shouldn't say they're not interrupted. You can, they're not interrupted because you can predict their movement. Whether they only have two options of where they're going. They're swinging back to the left. They're swinging to the right.
Right.
Okay. And the volatility is reduced significantly. And capital is then able to be predictable, and you're able to extract more under predictable circumstances.
Right. Yeah.
And the you know, poor folks trying to, you know, get themselves out of the sociocultural quagmire that is a part of all that requires some other force, which I do think there's all, this is always a cat and mouse type of a landscape, because, you know, I look at what is happening with technology, for example. Like, technology is so interrupted that the entire process, which, you know, and it can go either which way, but it has created an environment where it has upset the predictability of how the narrative and the myth can be controlled. Right. And for example, all this conversation around TikTok, right? There's all this conversation around now banning TikTok, right? Because TikTok makes it very difficult to maintain the social narrative, the myths and the narratives, when you have people with direct engagement, millions and millions, if not billions of people with direct engagement, who are telling their stories, telling history, being direct about their expression and experience of history. And it to have that happening at the same time that you have a conversation around around an insistence on banning books and this conversation can't happen and I don't want kids to feel bad in class, to have that conversation happen at the same time where a kid could be in class, pick up one of these in class, right, and have access to all of that, right, while you're denying them access to that themselves. We all know there's a certain ridiculousness to that. It makes it clear that it's not really about that. It's about something else.
Yeah.
And again, this is the reason why places like New Roads become so important, because trying to create an environment where you're preparing the next generation of leaders to be able to wade through all of that noise and confusion in order to be able to make sense of it. You know, one of the things that we've been discovering is that, listen, we have to start to really engage kids around media literacy and these kinds of conversations. These kinds of conversations are actually becoming more important than, you know, creating opportunities around learning around activism and preparing them about how to be activists. Well, this is kind of even actually larger than that, because this is the place where they're going to call all the tools and everything they use as activists. So they need to be able to move through all of this and have skills to be able to do that. And so it again reminds me of something that, again, you used to say, you know, 15 some odd years ago, you would say, we don't know what they're going to need to know 20 years from now. So what we're teaching them has to be a perspective and a way of engaging and interfacing with the world and seeking truth and clarity and honesty and authenticity, because the landscape is so dynamic, you cannot imagine what it's going to look like.
Absolutely. You can think you can, but you can't. You really can't. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, another thing I want to share on the CRT piece that is so troubling for me that gets missed about CRT, that I do directly bring to our inclusion discourse at New Roads. And that is a centerpiece to Derrick Bell's critical race theory is this notion of interest convergence. He had this concept called interest convergence. And what he did with interest convergence, he said he went through all of the significant civil rights measures that had ever been taken or remediative measures that had ever been taken around race in American culture, and he compiled a compendium. And in looking at this compendium, he said, okay, one thing becomes clear. Whenever there has been a remediative measure that has been embraced by the American public as a whole, it has been one that has benefited white people also. So then Derrick Bell says his concept of interest conversion is, well, the first two waves of social progress to move us beyond the apartheid history that we had should be centered in interest convergence. We should focus on the things where our interests come together and converge, so we know what we don't have to fight about and say, right, yes, we all agree. And now, I have never had an audience that I presented that to that did say, yes, yes, that's exactly what I want to hear. And then when I say to them, that's the centerpiece of critical race theory, you know, and I say, I want you to think about who this man was and what he was trying to do. He was very conservative himself. Derrick Bell was very conservative. He was not a radical. Okay. That's not the guy he was. Yeah. Okay. At all. And he would be the measured guy to move us along the path of social parity.
Take the simple, the low-hanging fruit first.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
He said. And so I get very frustrated sometimes when because we miss things like interest convergence, the football gets thrown way down the field, and now we start screaming at each other about pronouns and things like that, when there are other fundamental things that we have not even moved through yet to have clarified and have manifest at the social policy level, such that, you know, issues like pronouns and things like that are not such a big die on the hill fight.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. Dare we, and forgetting for a second the conversation about the schools, although obviously everything plays in, reparations. How do you feel about that? And I mean, I'm going to tie that to, you know, there is a sort of rejuvenation of, and a historical, there's a history of conservative, and I don't mean Trumpish. I mean, conservative Black thinkers, intellectuals in this world. And there's a resurgence among a certain slice of that world that I'm not even sure they're conservative, but careful thinkers who come out differently from the more progressive social movement. So I'm thinking of people like, Glenn Lowry, who's an economist, guy named John McWhorter, who's a linguist.
I know all those guys.
Coleman Hughes, who's actually a kid, who's really quite good. Or something. Thomas Sowell, who,
yes,
an economist, I think. So where are you in that? Well, how do you, or do you incorporate any of their insights? And I'm wondering how you feel about that.
Well, just let me just give some broad strokes, you know, from the beginning, is that I am of the mindset that you will never move in a significant way the social barometer, the sociocultural barometer around this issue without reparations. There's the level of assault and offense that African Americans encountered as a demographic. There's no other way around that. There is no other way around addressing that issue. Now, what happens is that we get lost in the details about what that looks like, right? And there are many different proposals of what that looks like. The first thing I'd like to do is to disavow in any way these caricature renditions of reparations, right? You know, that are quite frankly racist in their origin, right? Where a bunch of folks are just lined up for something free for a check. Give me this. Where are my reparations? Okay, you know, taking the conversation out of that zone and really respecting the conversation. When you look at the economic reality of where Black America is, that so specifically happened to them as a demographic. And you know, looking at what, I don't know if you're familiar with Hannah Nicole Jones and what she's doing with the 1619 Project, and looking at some of the things she uncovers just as historical truths and realities, really establishing the deep economy of the United States literally being founded on the grinding, if you will, to provide a metaphor there, of Black bodies, okay? Literally where people had lifespans that were tossed out afterwards to do certain functions that establish infrastructure that became the foundational infrastructure of the country. And then looking at where Black America is today, finding itself in many instances the lowest economic demographic of many groups that en masse arrived in the country afterwards and essentially took advantage of the infrastructure that they had created. And so it's very difficult to authentically have a meaningful conversation. And I'm going to include this part too, in a country that part of its national mythology, narrative, and lore is Christian based, right? To not have a conversation meaningfully about what is the recompense to those people. Okay. I think that's the only way you really stop just the noise. The noise is such a noisy conversation. And the majority of the noise just takes the place, centers around, well, there was never anything done to make those people whole. Okay, you know, passing a civil rights law is not about making those people whole. It's just saying, that's just saying, okay, well, we're living up to when we said all men were created equal. Now we're putting a little bit of force behind it, but that's not, yeah, that's right. That's not really recompense for those people. And so there was never anything, even when you're looking at Native Americans, right? And then that you do have a legal basis in 40 acres and a mule, right? You have a legal basis for compensation. Then when you add to that, that the first big national reparations movement took place after Reconstruction, when white slave owners were compensated for their losses, for their slaves. Yes. And the slaves were just cast off the land, right, and sent out to be terrorized by the Ku Klux Klan to be driven out of states, out of the South en masse. I think that it is all but impossible to move forward as a nation without there being a collective conversation around reparations. For me, practically, the way that that takes place is really through an institutional approach. I don't think it ever should descend to a conversation around checks and people and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But there should be an institutional approach, right? There should have long ago been a national trust set up so that Black families can get educated. Black families can say, we're going to buy our first piece of property. We can, right? There are smaller cities now that are
healthcare,
doing things like that.
Like, Brad, there's all sorts of institutions and practices that would avoid writing a check, or having to sit down after the meal and say, okay, we had the bacon, lettuce, and tomato, and
exactly,
had the, whatever. You had the liverwurst, so that's like,
exactly,
whatever. That goes nowhere, it seems to me, that. But
it goes nowhere,
institutional practices. Yeah. Yeah. It's insulting. And it also ties the conversation to slavery, which it's not that that wasn't real. But so even if there wasn't slavery, the way people have been treated historically, certain groups of people have been treated historically, is like, well, yeah, okay, my grandfather wasn't a slave, but that doesn't mean my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my whatever, were not mistreated, kept from participating in, denied this. Or me, right?
Absolutely.
Not me, but
and,
you.
And most importantly, which this is the part where I do take a certain level of guidance from the conservative Black voices, where some of them have done economic analyses, and you start talking about public policy, and you start talking about Black and brown bodies that finance that. Right. You know, when you look at homestead, you look at Social Security, you look at these big, major public policy initiatives that move massive amounts of whites out of lower and working class up into the burgeoning middle class, and it essentially being financed on the backs of poor Black and brown people who enjoy none of those benefits,
right,
who are excluded from those government programs.
Right.
The government participating in redlining and participating in,
sure,
specified loans that are, right? All of this, again, is what I think critical race theory is trying to get to.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's why, as I was saying, the social forces immediately reduce it to a caricature, because the social forces are actually very intelligent. They recognize that you have to stop it at this level before you get down to the micro level, because when you get down to the micro level, and this is what I think is really valuable and instructional about Hannah Nicole Jones's 1619 project, she does take us into the weeds. And there's one part of it where she takes you to a Louisiana law at the turn of the century that's on the books, where Blacks couldn't eat vanilla ice cream. And she actually takes you into the micro weeds. And just when people think that that's ridiculous, now we're looking at all these, bathroom laws and who can do this, and all these micro laws and targeted laws that are specifically directed to achieve a certain outcome, and you think, okay, they may sound ridiculous, but you're like, no, actually, they aren't ridiculous. They actually are part of, they serve a certain function in the stability, predictability of the landscape.
I am looking at the clock here, and you're probably looking at the clock there, and this is your vacation. I'm so grateful for our opportunity to have a conversation, and I'm so grateful for you, and I'm glad that I'm going to see you in a few weeks, and I love you, man.
I love you right back, David. This has been a great experience.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.